dreaming. I'm always dreaming. Dreaming.
Hello, I'm Bernadette Russell.
I'm Gareth Bridie.
And this is the second of our podcasts of short stories on the theme of dreams. We were recording this on the hottest day of the year.
Yeah, it's really boiling.
So we hope that you're listening to it later on, maybe with a G&T, as it's cooled down a little bit, just before you go to sleep. So we've got some great stories coming up. Before we start with the dream stories, just to let you know, our next live show is on the theme of monsters. It's on the 9th of September 2016 at Toynbee Studios, Arts Admin, as usual, near Olga East. And the deadline for interested writers is the 26th of August, midnight. So we're looking at stories around 1,000 words on the theme of monsters. To the usual address.
Okay, let's start from the beginning.
I'm always searching, hoping someday I'll find someone to love me.
This is Three Dreams by Michael Spring. The starlit path that leads from my house to yours is surrounded by malign deities. An old man offers me chocolate, presumably in return for sexual favours, but his hands look calloused and I despair of his touch. Something brushes the hem of my dress. My hair, blowing behind me, catches on a twig, or perhaps it's one of these troubled spirits clutching at it. I wouldn't blame you if they did. I've used a new conditioner, and this has made it sparkle, at least it did when first brushed. I sat there in front of my mirror, brushing my long hair, feeling pleased for you. You'll like it when I'm astride you, my shiny hair hanging down like a burnished veil. Perhaps then in that moment, you think I'm someone else, someone even your heart hardly knows you desire. I imagine tossing back my hair, throwing it back, smiling down at you. But the deities are in my mind too, and they've dressed me in a carnival mask. Instead of your sweet face contorted with pleasure, your head has become smooth, as featureless as an egg. Your body loses its urgency, the rhythm slackens, and it is over without conclusion. Strange how dreams become nightmares, how a twist in the lane finds owls and bats screeching at something unseen, and how the gravelled pathway that I walk each day becomes imbued with magic. That was in the night after you said you were leaving, that you were tired of me. I remember watching your car reverse out of the drive between the hedges. I remember watching the lights of the car fade into the distance as you, in all probability, breathed a sigh of relief. The wide lake is sparkling in the sunshine. It's hot and fish jump through the glassy surface, leaving something of themselves behind them in the water each time. I am umbilically connected, strong on a wire that leads to somewhere beyond the planet, a place where the small lake waves can't be peeled away from each other as though made of gelatin. And the priapic man with the black and grey moustache who smells of wet tweed and tobacco and pine oil still waves his brush at me while his thumb grips his oily palette. The portrait is a mess of colour. I'm naked and drunk. I've been lying on the soft turf under the hedge wearing high heels and a hat. The Queen swept by in her white carriage with black horses and effeminate coachmen in wigs who seemed to do nothing but smile at each other. And my flesh, because it's seen through bottle glass perhaps, has acquired a greenish tinge, especially where folds of skin sink into each other. When I look closer, small trees seem to be growing here, and the whole of my stomach has become a bosky landscape where minute creatures run. I scratch and scratch and scratch. It's only the rubberized restraint that prevents me scratching the skin away, ripping it like cling film, revealing the organs that lie beneath, quietly twitching in their bloody swamp. That was in the night after Miriam told me you two were getting married, going abroad. Miriam said that I too would eventually find happiness. I remember her waving through the plate glass window of the wine bar while the rain splashed on the pavements and cars. I suppose I always knew that you two were close. Her news, though, was a surprise. Oh, for a smooth wall. This one, the concrete one that I lean against, is pitted, and I fear to put my cheek against it. The wall becomes floor, which is polished and reeks of a school gymnasium. Someone is speaking Latin. Over by the far wall, a man in a leather cape hammers a glowing metal bar, which he grips with tongs. He wears a transparent visor. He's making, he says, a cage. The open fields appear as a wall dissolves, but their colours are wrong. The green of the fields has become orange. The slack streams are bright yellow like molten metal, and vapour rises from them. The clouds, high and fluffy, are black against a muddy sky. The wheel of a funfair revolves slowly and dismally in the next valley. Picking my way, choosing places carefully to put my dainty feet, across the field strewn with bloated corpses, I try to go faster, but I cannot without tripping or treading on one of the bodies. The satin shoes I'm wearing are stained, blood on their pinkness, their perfection spoilt. If you arrive, it'll be on a bus, I imagine, but suddenly there you are, except magnified to a huge scale, floating across the fields towards me, a balloon. I look down to my palm and find I'm clutching an angel, a small angel, which used to decorate a Christmas tree. That was in the night after Tim gave me news of you. I wonder if you ever thought of me in your sparkling foreign city. Tim said he thought you weren't happy there, in your snow-white apartment, overlooking the sea. We sat and talked of old times. Then he tried to put his hand up my skirt.
Michael Spring.
That's Three Dreams by Michael Spring.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right, this next story is by a regular contributor, Liam Hogan, and it's called The Storyteller. Are you sitting comfortably? The storyteller asked. I glanced at the empty blister pack on the bedside table, pulled the covers up to my neck and nodded. Then I'll begin. Once upon a time, it wasn't like this. Once, you hardly remembered your dreams, good or bad, and didn't need a storyteller to send you safely off to sleep. No one knows for sure what changed. A prion infecting the brain, perhaps. Increased solar activity? Or global warming? Or fracking? Or aliens? Whatever it was, dreams became more common and more powerful. Nowadays, a nightmare could kill you, or drive you insane, or maybe that was worse. So you made preparations to ensure sweet dreams. Stories were the key. If you were wealthy enough, you hired a storyteller to sit by the side of your bed and read you into a peaceful slumber. They'd stay with you until the sleeping tablet kicked in. The poor had to settle for recordings, podcasts, that sort of thing. Storytellers were preferable. They could adjust their tales to match your mood. Important on nights like tonight, my mind busy with the day's distractions. I zoned back into the story. Fairy tales, always fairy tales, and not the grim variety. These were happy ending guaranteed. Distant enough from real life not to trigger any unexpected emotions, but was common themes of good triumphing over evil, or princesses winning the hand of princesses, of ugly trolls smashing their way into the castle. I'm sorry, I interrupted. I may have tuned out a little there. Do you think you can start again? The look she gave me. I've not had this storyteller before, but her reaction was common enough. They're all so damnably precious, so sensitive about their stories. Even if at the end of the day it wasn't the stories that mattered, it was the state of your mind as you drifted off to sleep. Nothing they could conjure up could ever compare to what you're about to dream. The vivid technicolours and exhilarating rides of the subconscious. Their stories were just the appetizer, a nudge in the right direction to ward off dark thoughts. Like trolls smashing down the front door. Anyway, having finished giving me the look, she smiled, rather nastily. You should fall asleep in 7 minutes' time, so no, I can't start again. This is a 15-minute story. Would you like a recap? She asked, and I nodded, already composing an email in my head to send to the boss of Sandman Services Limited early the next morning. Sometimes artists forget who pays the bills.
Okay, she said.
The wicked stepmother sent out word to all the evil things of the kingdom, promised as much gold as they could carry, and no questions asked to anyone who rid her of the young princess before she turned 16. Are you with me so far? I raised a finger. Yes? This isn't one of the usual agency stories, is it? No, she agreed. Isn't it a bit dark?
Yes, I suppose it is. New company policy. Too many people not paying attention to stories they've heard a dozen times or more before. We need to spice things up a little.
But the point is still to have a happy ending, yes?
Absolutely, she beamed. The smile failed to reach her eyes. Which, if you let me continue, we're arriving 4 minutes.
I peered nervously at the countdown timer. With the latest sleeping pills, chemists could send you to sleep within a carefully calibrated 30-second interval. That was progress for you. It meant stories could be precisely timed and prevented all the ridiculous ad-libbing tellers you used to have to do to prevent a sudden ending from jarring you back to wakefulness just as you were drifting off. Maybe I shouldn't have interrupted her. But it's still only a fairy tale, after all.
Sorry. Please continue, I said. It was my best air of contrition.
My official complaint would make sure she never worked again, but the clock was ticking, and I could feel the tension building.
The storyteller tilted the angle-poised lamp towards the wine-coloured curtains, bathing the bedroom in a dismal glow before picking up the tale. As the troll burst into the entrance hall, shattered remnants of the oak door all around, the stable boy took his stand on the staircase, spear in one hand and shield in the other.
I nodded, relieved. It was corny. The young hero pretended to be a lowly worker, saving the day and winning the princess's hand before revealing that actually he was of royal descent, but at least this was known territory.
Alas, the troll was the least of the gathering foes, and now that the door was smashed, dark forces crept in, eager to claim the stepmother's prize. Nightcrawlers slinked, unseen across the ceiling towards the princess's chambers, the air turning stale and cold.
The bedroom was much too dark, shadows pooling in the corners. Shivering, I closed my eyes, but that was no better.
The stable boy bravely threw the spear, and his aim was true.
But the troll was a mountain troll. His skin thick and his muscles thicker. The spear only served to enrage him. I stared at her, my mouth agape as the timer ticked off its final minute. She placed a hand on my chest and began to press. The troll's fist wrapped around the weaponless hero's torso, squeezing until his ribs began to crack, tortured lungs collapsing, splinters of bones creeping towards his labouring heart. And then, just before it was pierced, he heard the final screams of his princess as the creatures of the night tore her apart.
The end.
You cretin, I said, a tremor in my voice. What sort of dream am I a bloody well going to have now?
What makes you think?
She hissed, needle teeth glittering in the blood-red light. That you're not already dreaming.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Liam, thank you so much. That was called Storyteller.
Thank you, Liam. By Charlie Abdullah Haddad and Tamara Schreiber, and it's called The King Who Fell in Love with a Voice. Once there was a king who was sad. The king was sad because he was afraid of sleeping. He tossed and turned in bed in dread of waking up and finding out that he's no longer the king. So the king searched his kingdom far and wide for a storyteller, someone with the perfect voice to read him to sleep. And after 40 days and nights, a perfect storyteller was found, and the king fell in love with his voice. Every night the king was read to by the perfect voice, and the king slept. The king was no longer afraid, but the king was very sad. Every night he was read to, and every morning he woke up sad, because he's no longer sleeping. So the king ordered the storyteller to tell him the longest story he'd ever known. The longest story the king ever knew was also the shortest story ever told. The king never again woke up, and never again felt sad. The storyteller felt cold and alone. He took the king's cape and put it on. And on the cape were embroidered in precious gems all the words in the kingdom. The storyteller sat on the empty throne. He started unpicking the words embroidered on the cape in stone. Every night he would erase one word from the cape and sew it on his heart. Every morning the new word, glowing and moist with his blood, would roll out of his mouth and echo to the far reaches of the kingdom. So the subjects felt there was order in the land and a ruler in the palace, and no one came to rouse the king. 40 days and nights after he told the king the longest story he knew, the shortest story ever told, he sewed the last word. He fell asleep on the throne. When he woke, the body of the king was gone. That morning he prepared to speak to the folk of the kingdom and tell them they were no longer subjected to a king. A perfect statement was composed. After all, his heart was covered in all the kingdom's words. But when he opened his mouth, nothing came out. Not one sound. He was no longer a storyteller. He became king. But the king was sad. So he searched through his kingdom for a storyteller.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much to Charlie Abdullah Haddad and Tamara Schreiber, and that was the fantastic The King Who Fell in Love with a Voice. Thank you.
Sing me to sleep, sing me to sleep. I'm tired and I want to go to bed. Sing me to sleep, sing me to sleep, and then leave me alone. Don't try to wake.
Okay, this next story is by Katarina Rankovic. It's called The City. The constituents of the city flickered like excited ashes. A city. It contains goings-ons. There runs a man, plagued by the apparition of a UFO, a near escape, and surely they'd be back for him again. They keep count. Obscured by the shadow of an alleyway, he regains his breath and peers around. Swirls of gust have poured in from the west like a torrent of entitled teenagers bullying the paper litter that whispers complaints as it scuttles along, gets caught into things. Ouch. A heel got stuck in a gutter and made a lady blush. Her foot scrambled in the shoe and her eyes darted around. The handbag that she otherwise brands as a shield is now getting tangled with her limbs, and her sunglasses are threatening to fall off her nose. The city has a healthy proportion of good, honest working people. They carry whatever they might need to carry out this work, such as a compass or a newspaper. A man rolls his newspaper and swats a fly. His menacing satisfaction is cut short by the victorious buzz of the enduring fly. It starts out of an inexplicable hiding place and cackles, carried off by wings of justice. Needless to say, a lot of manufacturing goes on in the city. They make small, colourful rubber balls that bounce like gleeful fleas and which irritate neighbours balancing the weight of bulging grocery bags, who, with the children chasing and the balls up in the air, did not include these factors in calculating the juggle from the car to the door. The door creaks open, or swings open, and hits the much-abused spot on the wallpaper behind, or jitters when the key impatiently negotiates the frigid lock. The door releases warm cooking smells. The door reluctantly reveals a secret. The doorknob is electric. The hand holds its breath. The intent is pensive. The hope is tame. The door is pushed anyway. The doors of the city slam and ease open like vascular valves or the hiccups of drunken mice in old cartoons. Erratically and absent-mindedly, they secrete and absorb, spluttering forth wanderers and messages. They obey the law of yes or no, but really this singular tyranny makes them appear rather unhinged. "Are you kidding me?" says the arms of the woman who locked herself out. That was a definite no. The sun warms her from behind, but she ignores its attempts to console her and storms off like an unappreciated daughter. A staple of society's underworld is soliciting stolen goods in a hardly a discreet manner. He is ambushing potential clients with the inside of his coat like a one-winged bat flapping around dazed by the sun. Pulling an all-dayer was a bad idea. Unwilling customers manoeuvre diagonally across the street, wearing pursed lips in avoidance of this vagrant. The injured bat plays a one-sided game of pong with pedestrians for the better part of the afternoon. Meanwhile, a gentleman in dark sunglasses waits, motionless in a car with a cup holder. He appears to be demonstrating the virtue of patience. And soon, on the very same street, from the other end, a cheery young volunteer armed with pamphlets joins a game of pong. An unlikely partner, thinks the one-winged bat, his unhelpfully thin moustache curling. Likewise, the volunteer with freshly washed hair and a badge of goodwill wrinkles his nose at his dubious neighbour. They size each other up like the cowboys do with their fingers tingle around their holsters. But soon, it was clear that they were friends, not foes, as they successfully herded distressed passers-by between them. A man has lost his map. He seems to be getting on better without it, to his surprise. Everything looks restored somehow. An uplifting, if risky, happenstance. He catches glimpses of himself in the rococo mirror, peeping from the clutter of the antique shop. Touching his face, he has a sudden impulse to rid himself of his moustache, buy new clothes and start over. He lets out a wisp of an incredulous giggle. What would happen if he grabbed the woman about to pass him now and kissed her? Would they run away? Would he smell her copper hair? Would he tickle his bare upper lip? Would her fingertips be roughened by the labour of her occupation? Would they jump through the keyhole of a sunset reborn? As she overtook him without regard for the outside world, cryptic thoughts inscribed on a troubled forehead, he simmered down and managed his excitement. He did later exchange his car for a motorcycle, though. As blatant as a spot of an ice cream nose, that's how obvious the logic of the city seems from here. Ice creams are engrossing that way. Peaceful torches, floating bouquets, pass from one hand to the next, pass from the cone to the ground, dragging the falling face of a young boy down with it, his whimper on the verge of cracking like a walnut. The city is a box of muffled melodrama obscured by a film of functionality. A vase is observed hobbling out of a second-story window in the quest for martyrdom. Early the next morning, a stolen halo of sunrise is quizzingly gathered at the boots of the maintenance worker leaning on his broom, taking a moment to shake his head at yet another shattered potential. From the inside of a window of a humid pub, a finger traces a grimy getaway on the misty pane. The naked elbow resting on the pane fancies itself instead in the passenger seat of a hurtling car, hair floating from roll-down window, a farewell handkerchief
fluttering on a cruise ship, fading off into the world without harbours. In this pub, lazy hands applaud the band, advocating strategic dishevelment and reappropriated embellishment. A single spontaneously converted fan stands in the table's midst, cradling a despondent bottle that looks like it had given up protesting long ago. The enthusiastic audience member is not wholly unfamiliar to us, for indeed we left him breathless in an alleyway a few streets back. He appears to have found a suitable sanctuary from extraterrestrial pursuit. More absurd than his flair for unintelligible karaoke, however, is a circle of heads turned away from him, pretending he's not there. This physical configuration of members of society at any given moment, sometimes referred to as the misinformed meerkat, performs this useful function of a social drain, reflecting the oft-quoted colloquial out of sight, out of mind. This mechanism can, however, backfire in the event of an underestimated anomaly, as was precisely the case in this very old pub on that particular afternoon. Rather than music, it was in fact a tremendous advance in intergalactic diplomacy which had called for the man's excessive rapture and, as was later determined, his jubilating rendition of the Klingon national anthem. To the great surprise of the general party, they soon felt the floor beneath them began to quake and pulsate, renegotiating everyone's footing. Sighing glasses toppled and dribbled as the entire pub, formerly a local respected family-owned business, scrambled onto spider-blade legs, creaking from groggy hibernation. Uprooted and with a crack of its knuckles, the legs on which the building clinged onto squatted, then sprung, then soared. The escapist by the window continued wistfully finger-painting the dusty glass long into the exosphere. It was not until Pegasus fell into alignment with the marks she had made on the pane that she stopped, awed by the premature fulfilment of her quiet hopes. A hitherto neglected, rather invisible inhabitant of the city, she was to be appointed high priestess of a fleet that over time found her superstition reasoning increasingly persuasive. Back in the city, the now toothless patch of land exposed since the disappearance of the pub, inspired but limited curiosity where the proverbial out of sight, out of mind, continued to remain the prevailing belief system amongst its inhabitants well into the next century.
Thank you very much for that story called The City by Katarina Rankovic. Thank you.
We laid down under the bamboo trees. I sang that jungle lullaby. Singing, swinging on a lazy afternoon in paradise.
This next and last story is by a friend of ours and a regular contributor to Isaac & Company called Alan McCormick. He often submits his stories with wonderful illustrations, which obviously you can't have the benefit of here because this is like an audio thing, isn't it? But this is a fantastic story. It's very short and sweet and it's called Trumpet Forsyth by Alan McCormick. Each midnight, Trumpet Forsyth leans out of his sixth floor bedroom window and blows out his horn. The first notes are avant-garde and complicated, angry, like his Guernica is inhabited by limbless limbo dancers and drowning hands. The next series of notes are big-nosed, sonny-rolling sax, then tall and meditative, and after that, a little fruitless, like a man growing wings to turn into a penguin that will never fly. A horse bray and neigh, a dog's head in a light bulb tree, and a dancing man falling flat on his face make up the final third. And then Trumpet Forsyth puts away his horn and lets the dogs, cats and manacled maniacs take up his clarion call to wake up the night. Thank you very much, Alan McCormick.
Brilliant, thank you, Alan.
Trumpet Forsyth. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. Our next podcast will be a Monsters theme podcast at some point to be decided in the future. I hope you all have a nice evening.
Dream well.
Sweet dreams.
Bye.